ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 2, Text 3, Translation and Commentary by His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Please don't stand with your back to Nityananda Prabhu. Atha kavir nama suyavadartha syada prabhato vyavasaya buddhihi Siddhen yathartena yateta tatra Parishramam tatra samikshamanaha Atha kavir nama suyavadartha Syada pramatto vyavasaya buddhihi Siddhen yathartena yateta tatra Parishramam tatra samikshamanaha Atha kavir nama suyavadartha Syada pramatto vyavasaya buddhihi Siddhen yathartena yateta tatra Parishramam tatra samikshamanaha Now the verse translation begins with the words, For this reason, and for this reason I will read the translation of the previous verse to give the context of this verse. The previous verse goes as follows. The way of presentation of the Vedic sounds is so bewildering that the intelligence of the people is directed to meaningless things like the heavenly kingdoms, etc. The conditioned souls hover in a dream of such heavenly, illusory pleasures, but actually they do not relish any tangible happiness in such places. Then the verse translation of this verse, which we just chanted, For this reason, the enlightened person should endeavor only for the minimum necessities of life while in the world of names. He should be intelligently fixed and never endeavor for unwanted things, being competent to perceive practically that all such endeavors are merely laboring hard for nothing. Do you have the Croatian translation there?
It's English.
Yeah. You don't have that? You have it in Serbo-Croatian. You call it Serbian.
It's okay.
Yeah. I'm just suggesting maybe in future. I think the Croatian people's intense dislike of Serbian may have gone down, right? So, purport. The Bhagavad Dharma or the cult of Srimad Bhagavatam is perfectly distinct from the way of fruitive activities, which are considered by the devotees to be merely a waste of time. It's not very easy to translate, is it? What do you think? It's not very easy to translate extemporaneously. When I speak, it'll be easier, but this is really, I know because sometimes I translate myself. So I'm just thinking, if you had the Serbian text, you didn't translate this in Croatian yet.
No.
Maybe you could, if you're not afraid of... Yeah. Okay. What should we do? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Because some of these things are there. Since that he is not interested in creating unwanted things for a situation which is not at all reality, but simply names of no more significance than the babble of sea waves. I wouldn't know how to translate that. I mean, I could try, and Croatian I don't know, but I could try translating it into Hindi or Bengali. But babble, exactly, you wouldn't get an exact word. I can try. Since the devotee, I can try in Bengali. Jehetu Bhagavan, Bhagavan e Bhakta, Shampurna Bhabe Janan, Tarakana Ruchi Nai, Unwanted Things, Ajacha, Boshtudeh, Shushti Kara, for a situation. I'm doing it bit by bit, but you actually have to translate the whole sentence. It's a net, take that. Unwanted, I said ajacha. That's. Anichit, maybe, I don't know. I'm just trying to think how to say that exactly in Bengali. It's all Sanskrit, actually. The Bengali words, ayacho, ajacho, or anichit, undesired. But it doesn't, yeah. Anyway, so let's try again. Translation. For this reason, the enlightened person should endeavor only for the minimum necessities of life while in the world of names. He should be intelligently fixed and never endeavor for unwanted things, being competent to perceive practically that all such endeavors are merely laboring hard for nothing. Purport, the Bhagavad Dharma, or the cult of Srimad Bhagavatam, is perfectly distinct from the way of fruitive activities, which are considered by the devotees to be merely a waste of time. The whole universe, or for that matter, all material existence, is moving on as jagat, simply for planning business to make one's position very comfortable or secure, although everyone sees that this existence is neither comfortable nor secure, nor can it ever become comfortable or secure at any stage of development. Those who are captivated by the illusory advancement of material civilization, following the way of phantasmagoria, are certainly madmen. The whole material creation is a jugglery of names only. In fact, it is nothing but a bewildering creation of matters like earth, water, and fire. The buildings, furniture, cars, bungalows, mills, factories, industries, peace, war, or even the highest perfection of material science, namely the atomic energy and electronics, are all simply bewildering names of material elements with their concomitant reactions of the three modes. That would be really tough to do. If you had to just translate it off the top of your head, it would be really tough. You must have had a hard time working on that, huh? Yeah. Since the devotee of the Lord knows them perfectly well, he is not interested in creating unwanted things for a situation which is not at all reality, but simply names of no more significance than the babble of sea waves. The great kings, leaders, and soldiers fight with one another in order to perpetuate their names in history. They are forgotten in due course of time, and they make place for another era in history. But the devotee realizes how much history and historical persons are useless products of flickering time. The fruitive worker aspires after a big fortune in the matter of wealth, woman, and worldly adoration. But those who are fixed in perfect reality are not at all interested in such false things. For them it is all a waste of time, since every second of human life is important. An enlightened man should be very careful to utilize time very cautiously. Ayushakshana ekopina labhya swarna koti bihi. This Srila Prabhupada used to quote in this regard, that even one moment of one's life cannot be gained or regained even with millions of gold coins, koti bihi, unlimited practically numbers of gold coins. Therefore, the transcendentalist desiring freedom from the clutches of Maya or the illusory activities of life is warned herewith not to be captivated by the external features of fruitive actors. Human life is never meant for sense gratification, but for self-realization. Srimad Bhagavatam instructs us solely on this subject from the very beginning to the end. Human life is simply meant for self-realization. The civilization which aims at this utmost perfection never indulges in creating unwanted things, and such a perfectional civilization prepares men only to accept the bare necessities of life or to follow the principle of the best use of a bad bargain. Our material bodies and our lives in that connection are bad bargains, because the living entity is actually spirit, and spiritual advancement of the living entity is absolutely necessary. Human life is intended for the realization of this important factor, and one should act accordingly, accepting only the bare necessities of life and depending more on God's gift without diversion of human energy for any other purpose, such as being mad for material enjoyment. Such materialistic advancement of civilization is called the civilization of the demons, which ultimately ends in wars and scarcity. The transcendentalist is specifically warned herewith to be fixed in mind, so that even if there is difficulty in plain living and high thinking, he will not budge even an inch from his stark determination. For a transcendentalist, it is a suicidal policy to be intimately in touch with the sense gratifiers of the world, because such a policy will frustrate the ultimate gain of life. Shukdev Goswami met Maharaj Parikshit when the latter felt the necessity for such a meeting. It is the duty of a transcendentalist to help persons who desire real salvation and to support the cause of salvation. One might note that Shukdev Goswami never met Maharaj Parikshit while he was ruling as a great king. For a transcendentalist, the mode of activities is explained in the next shloka. Om Jnanatime Randhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Namasrishtam Manamapi Shachiputra Matra Swarupam Rupam Tasyagajamuruparim Matarim Goshtavatim Radha Kundam Girivaramaho Radhika Madhavasham Prapto Yasya Pratita Kripaya Shri Gurum Tam Natosmi. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Atath Pada Kamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavanscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamscha. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Last time I spoke here, I was doing a bit of word jugglery, if you remember. starting off with, you can't say it is, You can't say it is not, you can't say it both is and is not, and you can't say it neither it is nor it is not, which sounds like a champion number one prize of word jugglery. But as I tried to point out, there is something aiming at sense or almost sense or sensible nonsense in all that nonsense. So I want to continue that theme by discussing this term here which Srila Prabhupada uses in the translation, the world of names. What does all that mean? Just one more point about nonsense. This set of possibilities, or which is actual or real, is vast, but it's limited. But this, linguistically speaking, the set of impossibilities is unlimited. For instance, what is the definition of a rhinoceros? You could define it. Ah, but then we'll find in this talk, maybe we can't define it. But anyway, when I say rhinoceros, in your mind, a certain image comes, right? How many heads does it have? One head. You don't have to say a one-headed rhinoceros. But so, rhinoceros by definition has one head. There might be some freak in nature where there are two. But as far as reality, as far as we know, there's no such thing as a two-headed rhinoceros or a three-headed rhinoceros. Just in the category of rhinoceri, there's an unlimited set of impossibilities. Nonsense. A thousand-headed rhinoceros. Not possible, at least within our understanding. So the set, words are combined to make sense. Just like I said that word, the effulgent darkness. The word effulgent has a meaning, the word darkness has a meaning, but when you combine them it becomes meaningless. So certain words have certain, words have specific meanings, and you can't ascribe other words to them which are not connected with their meaning. So you can't say effulgent darkness, dazzling darkness, three-mile-high rhinoceros. So the set of impossibilities is greater than the set of possibilities, as far as we know, if we come to empiricism. Now, what is this world of names? World of names means, as Srila Prabhupada points out here in this purport, it's designations. This whole world is a world of designations. Words designate certain objects, actions, and ideas. Right? So if we say man, it designates a whole set of humans. Approximately half the human race is designated. Well, there's the term boy also. So, the term man, it designates, and it brings to mind an image, which is different from woman. The term tree gives to mind an image which is different from animal. So in this way there are certain words which are assigned to certain objects and to certain emotions, certain ideas. And there are words also which are intensifiers, like the word very. There are adjectives, like effulgent, they all have meanings, but ultimately everything in this world is temporary and meaningless. We are told that pure devotional service means to be free of designations. Sarvo padhi vinir muktam tatparatvena nirmalam hrishikena hrishikesha sevanam bhakti ruchate. Pure devotional service means to be free of all designations and to come to the higher platform, the superior platform of serving the with the senses, the master of the senses, and that's called devotional service. So free of designations means, what does that mean? That means that when we're talking about worship of Krishna, there are no designations there, because nama nami abhinna, the who is named and the name, they are non-different. It's an eternal attribute. Krishna's attributes are eternal. He is Satchidananda, Satyam Shivam Sundaram. He is eternal, all auspicious. He is truth, he is reality, he is all auspicious, he is beautiful. So these are not designations, because they're not some, it's not a concept which is formed in the mind, but Krishna is eternally like that. He doesn't change. So there are names also in the spiritual world, but the names designate, or not exactly designate, but they identify reality. Whereas in this material world, we put a name on something, but the name is not synonymous with its actual identity. It's a temporary identity. Okay, a child is born. Now, these days, by sonography or whatever, you can find out before the child is born what the gender will be. Although sometimes they make mistakes, even so. But you can have a good, pretty good guess what the gender will be. But previously, you had to wait till the little thing popped out, and well, they don't go pop, do they? Well, sometimes I've seen, not, I haven't seen a human child being born, but I've seen cows getting born, and sometimes they come out pretty quickly, just like that. So anyway, and then the first thing you do is look and see, it's a boy, or it's a girl, or whatever. At least in India, they'll say, it's a boy, it's a girl. Times are changing. Don't worry, ladies, times are changing in India still. So, boy or girl, it makes a big difference, doesn't it, to the whole way they are perceived. There's this idea, there should be blue for boys and pink for girls, isn't it? And boys should be tough. I remember as a child being told, when I cry over something, I fall over and get cut. And yeah, big boys don't cry. I guess they say a similar thing in Croatia, right? Big boys don't cry. And then, oh, okay, I got. Here I am, 3 years old, and I gotta be tough, right? Some idea of being tough. And boys play soccer, and girls play netball. I don't know, netball is something like basketball, something like that, in England anyway. So the different kinds of sports, that's changing now also. They have women's weightlifting, seems very strange to me, man. Women's boxing. This feminism is not so much about being feminine, it's about women becoming masculine, right? So anyway, there's an idea which feminists, they're trying to eliminate all of that, but and make it unigender. But there are designations. Men are supposed to be like this, women are supposed to be like that, and there's a whole culture behind it, what a man is supposed to be. And it'll be a little different in different cultures throughout the world, but basically there are masculine qualities and feminine qualities. But then the thing is, in the next life, the boy may become a girl. The girl may become a boy. And nowadays, even in this life, may attempt to do so, not very satisfactorily. We don't choose that, right? You don't choose to be a boy or a girl. We get our birth according to, how is that? Karmana daiva netrena jantur dehopa pateya. According to our previous activities, according to our previous desires, we get a certain kind of body. We don't choose it, we get given it according to the direction of the Supreme Lord and His representatives. That's how it works. So we're controlled by the Supreme Lord, and to a large extent we're controlled by the culture that we're born into. We don't think about it much. Definitely children don't think about it. But they're taught, yeah, just like that. Big boys don't cry. And boys play with toy cars, and girls play with Barbie dolls, and there's a whole set of expectations. And depending on the family we're born in, there's a whole set of cultural expectations which go with it. This is a Muslim boy. This is a Catholic boy. And so, this is a Jewish. So that the Jewish gives racial as well as religious. So we are a good family. You boy, you don't go and mix with those children. They're working class. They're rabble. You don't mix with them. You have to mix with your children should mix with the good children. I don't know if that's there in your ex-socialist country, but Britain is, where I was raised, is one of the most class-conscious countries in the world, as far as I know. So that idea was there. You don't mix like that. And even the people of working class, they don't want their children to mix with the higher class. So it's like that. There are so many designations, and we're raised according to the expectations of the culture that we're raised in. And there is this idea, well, you have to let people decide when they grow up what they want to do and how they want to be, but it's already decided for them to a large extent. And even if you say that, well, let them just choose, but they're surrounded by so many other people, and sangat sanjayate kamaha, our desires develop according to our association. So there's no such thing as just we decide completely by ourselves, because we're influenced by so many designations all around us. We want to fit a designation. We want to have a big, strong body, or a beautiful, attractive body, or according to the expectation of our parents may want that you study and become a good student and go to a good university. So we, according to the expectations of others, who are operating according to the culture that they're living in, the idea that if my boy is going to a prestigious university, so that's, then we will be more respected in society. We'll have a higher designation than the people of a lower designation. I got this from quotation found from a Back to Godhead magazine that psychologist Rollo May quotes one of his patients as saying, "I am just a collection of mirrors reflecting what everyone else expects of me." And therefore we have the whole idea of find yourself, be yourself, don't let anyone dictate to you, discover yourself, self-actualization, which goes on under the rubric of New Age. Find yourself. The thing is, they don't have any idea who they are. So it becomes very difficult to find yourself. They identify with the mind and the body. And therefore, when they try to find themselves, all they find is a whole bunch of material desires. So then what happens, people, they get the idea that spiritualism means to become devoid of any personality whatsoever. Because as long as we have some personality, it means we're interacting with others, we are dependent to some extent on others. So the idea, myself, I should discover, which is independent of everyone. And then you come to impersonalism. This is where it all leads to. And New Ageism, all this discover yourself, it's all impersonal, isn't it? It's not a developed impersonal philosophy as is there or in India traditionally, but it all tends to impersonal. When people set out to find themselves, they never find themselves as a servant of God because they're putting the emphasis on themselves, myself. I am so important, I have to find myself. Now, I'm going to talk about this world of names. There's a whole philosophy called nominalism, or a branch of philosophy in the Western world. Nominalism, which the term nominalism comes from name, and it is it's concerned with metaphysics or ontology or the inner essence, the nature of everything, but it's also very much linked with philosophy of language, and it's not new. It's been, at least its roots are found about 1,000 years ago, and it has had a profound effect on the whole development of Western society, even though most people have never heard of it. So the word nominalism in the world of names, we're talking about the world of names, it's actually used for different strains of philosophy, but the traditional sense, going back hundreds of years, is that it rejects universals. And I'll explain that. Or in a more modern sense, it rejects the reality, or that there are such things as abstract objects. So, rejecting universals. What is a universal? A universal is something like love, beauty, truth. Now, according to the... I'm talking broadly here, because if we get into philosophy, we'll find na savrishe yasya matang na bhinnam. It's true not only in ancient India, but it's true in the modern world also. And as long as philosophy goes on in this world of names, we will find that every philosopher has a different opinion to everyone else. Otherwise, he's not a philosopher. How can you be a philosopher unless you have a different philosophy? Otherwise, you're just a student of philosophy, isn't it? If you just study other philosophers, then you're not a philosopher, you're a student of philosophy. But a philosopher means one who has his own philosophy. So na savrishe yasya matam na binnam. Every philosopher has a different idea. That's exactly what this line from Mahabharata says. So there are different strains of nominalism, and if a professional philosopher, student of philosophy or professor of philosophy was to hear me speak, they'd say, no, it's not like that. But I'm just trying to give it very simply. So, the idea is that an individual may have a sense of love, or an individual may have a sense of beauty, but there's no such thing as beauty or love, or truth, or compassion, or wisdom, or any such thing. It's just, we think of such things, but there's no such thing. Actually, there is no such thing in the sense that it's not a solid object that you can touch, taste, smell, feel, measure, and so on. But according to the nominalists, and this is really beginning with this William of Ockham. You might have heard of Ockham's razor, whose idea was that we should express things as simply as possible. The best explanation is that which is the simplest. Don't bring in anything extraneous. For instance, if we want to explain the existence of the world, this is an updated example. If we want to explain the existence of the world, it's possible to explain it only in terms of matter. There's no need of any God. Well, that's where Occam's razor leads to. It leads to empiricism, subjectivity, solipsism, which means that I can only, well, okay. I can't be sure of anything except what I can touch, taste, smell, feel, and hear. And I don't even know if you exist at all, because I don't really know, do I? It leads to subjectivity and giving great stress to the individual, individualism. Because, and then in the another version of nominalism denies the existence, of any abstract objects. Things that do not exist in space or time. So it's the idea that what they call generalisms, we can't really talk of them because you can't really describe it. Just like a rhinoceros, you can describe, well, even then, you can describe one rhinoceros, but that's another thing, nominalism. There's no such thing as, you can say this is a rhinoceros, but you can't say there's a category because you can't specifically define what a rhinoceros is because everyone is different from the other. Therefore, they say there's no such thing as the category of rhinoceri. And it comes pretty absurd, actually, and you might think, well, how could such a philosophy be accepted at all? But it has been very, very influential. In understanding the nature of reality, or misunderstanding the nature of reality, that reality, you can talk about rhinoceros only because it's there, but you can't talk about a class of rhinoceri because there's actually no such thing. It's just in the mind there's a class of rhinoceri. This is what they say. But if you see an actual rhinoceros, then run like hell. But but if you see one, you can say, okay, that's a rhinoceros. But to postulate and say there's a whole class of them. It's only in the mind. So where is it actually? I mean, where is it? Where are all these rhinoceri? It's only in the mind. It's not a reality. So they say. I'm not saying it. That's what they say. So, what about numbers? What is a number? It's a concept, is it? You say a number, that's also three what? There have to be three some things. But in mathematics, you don't say, if you multiply three by three, you don't say three bananas by three bananas. You can say three x, but then x is indeterminate. A number is what? It's also a concept, right? There's no actual three. There's no three. Only if you bring three things, you can say one, two, three. But three, what is three? It's a concept in the mind. That's all, according to them. Could also be said that three is something written on a piece of paper. That becomes, when you write it down, then you have something, because it's solid. So, realism, the opposite of nominalism is realism. The idea that actually there is such, it's not just a concept, but there is such a thing as love, truth, beauty, strength, humanity. There is, it's not a thing in the sense that a pin or a nail is a thing, but it is, there is a real existence of such things as beauty, truth, etc. Now, what this comes to, what you're coming to in nominalism is that there are no qualities. Quality is it's an abstract concept, right? When we're talking about strength, beauty, truth, humanity, we're talking about all of these are understood by their qualities. Love is understood by its quality and its opposite to hatred. But if you say it doesn't exist, then what do we come to? No qualities. What's that called in Sanskrit? No qualities? Nirvishesha. There you go. The danger of this idea. So, practically speaking, the religions of the West have been very much influenced by this. And what to speak of India and the whole world. And we have Buddhism, which completely is predicated totally on this. You can't say it is, you can't say it is not, you can't say both is and isn't. And is not, you can't say that neither it is and it is not. It's totally predicated on the idea that there's no actual reality. And even to say there's no actual reality, there's no reality in saying there's no actual reality. And you could go on with an infinite regress. There's no actual reality in saying there's no actual reality in no actual reality. And you could go on forever like that. So, we here, folks, are transcendental realists, right? The Atma is real. This world is unreal in one sense. The Shankaracharya says, Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya. This Brahma is real, the Absolute Truth is real, and this world is false. But we say that this world is false in some ways, but in other ways it's real. And again, you come to the point. You want to get to real philosophy, pain is real. The philosopher may be talking all these things, nothing is real, nothing exists. Hit him on the head with a hammer. Oh, sorry, parampara. Kick him in the face with boot, right? Anyway, they both have the same import. Pain is real. So, there is existence. But this world is the world of names. We Namasu. In this world of names, we understand that nothing here is real in the full and complete sense. It is relative reality, which means that it's not really real, but it has reality in as much as it is a reflection of the actual reality. Ritayatam na pratiyeta na priyeta na. What is that verse? Na priti na priyeta atmani. Now I forgot it. Can someone look that up? Ritayatam yad pratiyeta na priyeta. I forgot it. Okay, I'll look it up. Ritayatam. It's an important verse, but I forgot it because my brain is half dead. Oh, do I have an excuse? No. Ritayatam. Ah, there it goes. Okay, ritayatam yat pratiyeta na pratiyeta chatmani tad vidyad atmano mayam yata bhaso yata tamaha. What is the world of illusion? It has no actual reality, but it has no solid reality, but it is like a reflection within the darkness. This world, it's the world of ignorance, but it is a reflection of the actual world. So we can't say it doesn't exist. Is a reflection real? Is a dream real? Yes and no. A reflection is a reflection of your face. It's not a real face, but it has its own reality. Is a dream real? In my dream, I jumped over Mount Everest and landed in a pot of boiling oil. Nonsense. But I experienced it in a dream. Is it real? No, because I didn't jump over Mount Everest, nor can anyone jump over Mount Everest. But the dream has its own reality. So it's not real, but in another sense it is real. The Roman Catholic Church in the 1960s succumbed to hundreds and hundreds of years of attack from empiricism, rationalism, enlightenment. Enlightenment means we go beyond all the ideas that the Catholic Church told us, and we just find out using our own brains, our own human intelligence. It's the enlightenment is the the worship of the human. And then you don't need God, right? With Charles Darwin especially, there's no Occam's razor. Humans have descended from, originally the idea was that they descended from monkeys, and then the idea is that they descended, there were humans, monkeys, dogs, cats, etc. They all come from an original common ancestor. And then there's biological evolution, the evolution of the universe from a big bang. There's no need of any God in a big bang, and everything settles into place. So with Occam's razor, we don't need God. You can believe in God, but Occam's razor means that you just take the most simple explanation. If you don't need God to explain it, then why bring God in at all? And that's what Richard Dawkins says, that theologians, they bring in God. When we don't understand anything, we say it must be God. And then science discovers that, oh, actually this is the reason. And then, you know, you don't need God to explain that anymore. He calls it the God of the gaps. But there'll always be gaps, because there'll always be gaps in our understanding. This ideal, the world of names, just reduce everything to what we can understand subjectively. And anything beyond that, we can't accept that it exists, actually. Oh, I said in the 1960s, the Roman Catholic Church succumbed, and that was the Vatican II, and then they admitted, yes, actually, science, what they say about evolution and this and that, we accept that. And then this idea that priests and nuns should live a very rigid life, they relaxed that. So I used to see in my early childhood, the nuns, they would wear their habits down to their ankles, and then after Vatican II, they started wearing short skirts. Why should a nun wear a short skirt? And then the idea that we have to follow strictly all these rules of religion said, no, just you have to follow your own mind. And then they followed their own mind, and then we found the priests and don't have all these inhibitions. And then we found the priests and nuns marrying each other, and the church as it was is no longer, because they opened it up to the idea, to the humanistic idea that, well, why should we have any inhibitions? If there's no actual thing as truth or justice or reality, it's just a construct in the mind. And what does it lead to? It leads to impersonalism, and it leads to amoralism, actually. Richard Dawkins, the most famous spokesman for atheism in recent years, in confronting the what is considered by theists to be a major weapon in their arsenal in arguing against atheism, they say, well, we can't have morality unless there's a higher principle. There's something beyond simply our existence. In other words, good and bad, they're also concepts, right? There's no actual thing as good and bad. And if we say that anyway, dust thou art and unto dust thou shalt return, this body is just a lump of chemicals. So what does it matter if this lump of chemicals gets a machine gun and shoots another bunch of chemicals, and the bunch of chemicals ceases to exist in that particular form? In other words, the bunch of chemicals upon being hit by a spray of bullets exudes blood out of its form changes, and blood comes out and it keels over and we say it's dead. But actually, what's dead? Because there's no life. Life is just a certain combination of chemicals in a certain state, and the chemicals change. So it's only the chemicals change their state, so there's no good or bad about it. Right? Where does the morality come from? The sense of good and bad, suggests there is a higher order. There is universal good. There is universally, it is considered good to be considerate of others, to not unnecessarily inflict pain on others. Sometimes it may be necessary. You do it all the time, right, doctor? You're always inflicting pain on others. But it's necessary. The doctor has to inject, cut, and inflict mental pain by saying, excuse me, you've got level 3 cancer and you're going to die soon. Most likely. Of course, you get training in how to say it also, right? So as to make it as palatable as possible. So these are universal principles of good. And almost universally, people in the world will accept that in recent history, Hitler was not good. He was bad. Stalin was bad. Pol Pot was bad because they inflicted massive suffering on others without any good reason, if there could be any good reason for inflicting mass suffering on others. Well, anyway, Richard Dawkins' reply to this, that without accepting the existence of God, there can be no morality. He said, well, we can work out morality ourselves. We don't need the existence of God. He sidestepped the question. Because there is no God. If everything is just as we perceive it, and everything is simply a combination of chemicals or energies, everything is material, everything is mundane. And again, talking about the world of names, we call something good, we call something bad, but actually there is no good or bad. He sidestepped the question. So good or bad, this comes because there is an ultimate good, an ultimate bad. And what is that ultimate good? Well, the ultimate good is the situation in which everyone can be happy eternally. There's no suffering, there's no pain, there's no anxiety, there's no exploitation, there's no hatred. There's love. But if we say, well, there's no such thing as love, no such thing as hatred, no such thing as pain, because these are just concepts, then the whole idea of God, the reality of God, goes out. So this world is a world of names, but it is the reflection of the real world, where there are names there also. But in this world, there are names for various objects, and even the concepts of good and bad. Now we're going to agree a little bit with here that the concepts of good and bad, but because it's a perverse reflection of the real world, then what we think to be good in this world is not the ultimate good, because we think that what is good is what is good for my body or for what we identify with. It would be good if Croatia won the World Cup, right? It would be good. You think like that. You don't think like that because you're devotees, but Croatian people think like that, right? He thinks like that. It's hard to get rid of, right? Even philosophically knowing what's right and what's wrong. So it would be good. But thinking like that, that covers our knowledge and our endeavor to find out what is really good for us. As long as we're thinking something in this world is good, then we're locked out from the real good, which is to understand that everything in this world is temporary. The pleasures and even the pains of this world are ephemeral, temporary, non-lasting. Therefore, we should come to the real world. So therefore, this verse is telling us, don't get caught up in this world of names. Come to the reality. Tamasima. Tamasijyotirgamaya. Come out of the darkness, come to the light. And this will be discussed in the upcoming verses. Just yavadartha. One should live just as much as is needed. We are in this world. We are conditioned by this world. But we should live in this world just as much as needed, not more. Don't get entangled. So in the next verses we'll find that we don't just live as simply as possible without getting entangled in all the entanglements of this material world. Live as simply as possible and keep focused on the world which is beyond the world of illusory names. So that's a little more on try a little more of a devotee or Vaishnava perspective on linguistic philosophy or philosophy of language, a little bit more. But it all gets interlinked. The nominalism, the idea that words, they just represent something. But there's no reality behind it. It's true to some extent. But if we take it to the full extent, then we deny the reality of truth, beauty, love, Krishna, ourselves. What about nominalism? That's just an idea, right? It's a concept. You can't pick it up, measure it. It's also just a concept. And then you come to that I was talking about last time, Ludwig Wittgenstein. He said, well, there's no need of it. Philosophy is just an idea. There's no need of any philosophy. It's just all we're doing is when we're talking and we're talking about knowledge and this and that, it's all just some games in our mind. That's what it comes to. It reduces the whole endeavor, philosophy, the search for love of truth. Philosophy means the love, just reduces it to, anyway, you're just talking something, he's talking something, and there's nothing, there's no meaning to it, anything at all. Then we come to nihilism, and just nothing to live for, nothing there. It's soul-killing ideas, actually. This idea of find yourself, it's without understanding who we are, it's without learning who we are, just the idea I can find myself it amid all the unlimited mundane desires and misconceptions, and we want to sort it all out and find who I actually am. It's vanity to think that we can do so. Therefore, tad vijnanartham saguru meva abhigacchat. For the sake of getting that knowledge which lifts us beyond this world of vainglorious struggle. Vainglorious means foolish pride. As if pride could not be foolish. Bravado. Yeah. I can find myself, by myself. Going beyond that, tadvigyan, to get that knowledge, one has to approach a guru who will tell us what is actual reality. And I'd like to speak some more about that in another talk. Not now. Hare Krishna. Any question? I saw one hand go up first, because... Okay.
No, just reminding you, last time when we standed up, you said, oh, I have something more to tell you, but I will tell you next time. Just reminding you, if you said...
Okay,
no,
yeah, I said it already.
Already, okay then, thank you.
What was it? Let's go up and say it again. Oh yeah, the set of impossibilities is greater than the set of possibilities. I said it at the beginning. Yeah.
Hare Krishna. I have actually a question about feminism. I have some friends.
There's no such thing as feminism, it's just a concept.
Yes, of course. They have this concept. I have friends in Austria, I live there, and they have this idea about matriarchy and so on. And they ask me always, why God, why Krishna, why whichever God's incarnation, for example, Vishnu's incarnations.
Why is God male?
Yes.
Well, there is Mohini Murti, she's female. God is male because he's the supreme enjoyer.
But they ask also why also gurus are only males.
Ah, well, that's a big topic. Have you seen that book I made, the Mothers and Masters book?
I should get it.
Yeah, you should get it. In brief, male and female bodies are given. according to previous activities and desires, they have different functions, right? With the different functions of the body. Basically, the female body has a very different function, in as much as the female body carries the child in the womb and nurtures the baby with milk and love. And the male form has a different propensity, and a different mentality goes with that also. And also, anyway, it's a huge topic. And kindly read that book. Do we have copies of that here? Yeah, you can give it to her.
Thank you very much.
It's this feminism is another kind of impersonalism, or nirvishesh. There's no difference between male and female, but what they do, feminism, they're not becoming more feminine, they're just trying to be masculine, that's all. Because there's only masculine and feminine, so they don't like their feminine role, so they're trying to become masculine. So it should be called masculinism, actually, or imitation masculinism, femi-masculinism, I don't know. Something like that. Yeah.
So you said that solution is not to be entangled in this world and live as simply as possible.
Yeah.
So this is also not a solid category. How you will define this as simple as possible for one person?
How to live as simply as possible? Well, that comes up in the next few verses. Next verse after this, I'll give. When there are ample earthly flats to lie on, then what is the necessity of cots and beds? If you can sleep on the floor, you don't need a bed. When one can use his own arms, then what is the need of a pillow? When one can use the palms of his hand, what is the use of any utensils? This is pretty extreme. We don't do that. When there is ample covering of the skins of trees, then what is the necessity of clothing? Maybe in Croatia in the winter you need more than skins of trees to cover the body. Then the famous verse, Chirani King Patina Santi Disha, not very famous, a little bit famous, Dishanti Bhiksham. Naivang Ripa Paribrita Sarito Pya Shushyan Rudha Guha Kim Majito Vati No Pasanan Kasmad Bhajanti Kavayo Dhanadur Madanda. At least the last line is a little famous. Are there no torn clothes lying on the common road? This is for sadhus. No need to work to buy clothes. You just find some torn clothes and put that on. Gorky Shodas Babaji was doing like that. Do the trees which exist for maintaining others no longer give alms in charity? So that's it. This is giving the, what we might say, the extreme, but that's the idea. Vedic culture means Varnashram, Brahminical culture. Means that not everyone's a Brahmin, but the Brahmin standard, that's the standard to be aimed at. That everyone sees that's the highest culture, and everyone's influenced by that. So a Brahmin should live as simply as possible. Yeah, there are many things to be discussed, but I'll not discuss more now because it's getting a little late. Clothes from trees, tree bark, dal kala, it's called tree bark. No, you don't see sadhus in India wearing that. Well, some sadhus, they don't wear anything still up to the present day. Especially Jain sadhus. Digamba they're called. It means the directions. Amba is their clothing, so their clothing is the directions, that's all. They walk around. You don't see many of them. Like that. Then it's fairly common to just have a kopien, nothing else, for sadhus. Like that. Tree bark, or maybe antelope skin, previously. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't like that. Still today you'll find many sadhus in India. They live very, very simply. They deliberately. Most of them, actually. Srila Prabhupada pointed out in that book, Renunciation Through Wisdom, that they may smoke bidi, but basically they live very, very simply. And they're not interested in gross materialism. I remember once I went to Kurukshetra, it was in the winter, it's very cold. And at night, there's the Brahma Sarovar is there, and that's the water, which is the place where Parashuram made the lakes of blood. Now there's lakes of water. So you'll find there's some, just next to that, there's some, it's all been paved. That was done by that ex-prime minister, what's his name? Nanda. And so there's some paved area, and then there's a wall, and then there's a covering. So it's open on one side and closed on three sides. And I came early in the morning to chant japa there, and you find the sadhus, they're sleeping there with one or two blankets, out in the cold in the winter. They live like that. And they go from one holy place to another. So the idea is to live as simply as possible. That they do. Still. Hare Krishna, vancha kalpatarubhyascha kripa sindhubhya vacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha.